Before we get started with today's podcast, we'd like to ask returning listeners to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcast platform, iTunes, Spotify, SoundCloud, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you really enjoy it, share a link to this podcast with friends or family who would enjoy hearing our weekly discussions about basketball and basketball culture. Now, on to the show.
Yeah, isn't it amazing when Michigan can keep this game to a 19-foot, 9-inch game inside that three-point line? It's all there. Nice move by Steve Fisher here.
Welcome to the 19-9 podcast. This evening, we're putting in extra work at Station 13, breaking down the rise of the NBA with Pete Corrado, author of From Hang Time to Prime Time, Business, Entertainment, and the Birth of the Modern NBA. Welcome, Pete. How are you, man?
Good, Aaron. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Hey, I want to start off. This is a thing. So I'm in education, and one of the things I loved about the book, and we won't give away the hook, but I'm curious, you know, always love writing. How did you come up with the kind of hook, the way you jump into this book? Because I love just kind of the way it like was out of the blue and caught me off guard, because I'm expecting immediately, like, you know, to be talking 90s Knicks with you or something. And it's just not that way. So I'm just curious about your process as an author and how you come up with something to catch people right at the start of a book.
Yeah, I guess you're referring to the Derek Fisher, yes. Dancing at the Stars.
That's it.
Yeah, no. To me, like, that encapsulated what the, you know. Let me think about this, because that's a really good question. To me, that represented just how far the NBA had come in terms of being mainstream entertainment. For those who forgot, and if you have, good for you, because it's a horrifying piece of footage. But back in 2017, Derek Fisher, who was former NBA coach, Lakers point guard with Kobe and Shaq, appeared on Dancing with the Stars. And I think during his first performance, he did a routine to Curtis Blow's old school rap classic Basketball, dancing around in like a sequin outfit with a basketball, and it's absolutely ridiculous. I mean, yeah. it was one of the, back in 2017, you know, if you're a denizen of NBA Twitter,
yeah,
like that was the topic of a discussion for like a good 3 hours. It's just, can you believe what's happening here? But to me, you know, as someone who's an old school NBA fan, someone who I think is a fan of the history of the game, that I think that minute and a half clip was truly significant, because if that clip had surfaced in 1983 or like 1985, America's TV viewing public would have gone bananas, because you know, you have an African American man in a predominantly black sport,
yeah,
dancing around to a rap song.
Yeah.
And in 2017, it's no one cared.
Yeah.
Or they cared in a way that it was just like, oh, look at this goofy thing.
It's almost Disney, right?
Exactly. So when I was writing the book, or starting to write the book, and I needed an introduction, I needed a quick way to show people, like, here's how we got here, here's what, how it used to be. To me, that clip was like manna, because it showed everything. It showed everything that I was trying to describe in the book, and showed what the NBA had become in terms of being a part of mainstream culture, along with rap music,
yeah,
in a minute and 30 seconds. So when that happened, it was funny, when I was thinking of how to write that introduction or write that forward, I came back to that and I thought, oh yeah, that's everything I need is right there. And then getting to ask Curtis Blow about that was even was even funnier.
Hold on. You got to ask Curtis Blow about that too?
I did.
What did he say?
He was like, yeah, I liked it. Yeah, I thought it was great. Which is like the last thing I expected, yeah, Curtis Blow to say. Curtis Blow's going to say, eh, you know,
the nadir of my career.
I would have preferred Derek had not done that, but he was cool with it.
That's cool.
And I guess, you know, and to me, that clip shows just how everything has changed in 30 to 40 years, where you can have a black man perform, you know, a black athlete in a predominantly black sport dancing around to a to a rap song, even though it's sugarcoated.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly fine. No one complains about it.
Yeah,
that to me was a remarkable snapshot of where we've come from.
Well, gets us right into it too. And I think the other thing that, of course, really caught my eye. So Peter Robert Casey of Slam is the connection for the book. So he gives it to Josh, and then Josh tells me about it. And the first thing that catches my eye is the cover. So I'm also always fascinated too, like how a cover comes together, because this is like, you know, the Slam cover is so central to my basketball youth, and it's such a piece of real estate that's really important. And I know authors really value that, because you have so little time, if people don't, you know, get it handed to me like I did, to catch someone's eye. So just curious, because I really like the cover, how that came together.
No, thanks. The cover, you know, it's funny. I didn't really have much to do with the cover. That was done. That was an in-house job with Atria Books, the publisher. And the guy who did it, I think his name is James Icobelli. I hope I'm pronouncing the name right. He did a phenomenal job. And, you know, I love the cover, because I think it just it encapsulates. There's that word again.
Yeah.
The book in one very quick image. It just shows sort of the evolution of the NBA in this figure, you know, head for TV, exactly. You know, gold basketball sneakers. You know, I believe there's a hamburger in his hand.
Yeah.
And my editor, my former editor, Rakesh Sital, he said that, you know, the idea for the cover was to make it look like a Wheaties box. And to me, I think that the cover, which I think is more than I deserve, I think it describes the book perfectly, because to me, this is not really a straight ahead MBA book. To me, it's a book that could also be about business. It covers business, it covers social history, covers American history, it covers pop culture. So to me, that cover is perfectly brings everything in together. And yeah, I mean, I guess I could have protested and said, you know, I want Jordan on the cover or Magic Johnson, but then it blends with everything else. And to me, you know, Magic Bird and MJ, you know, those great players, you know, they're part of the book, and they're part of the narrative, but they're not the driving force. To me, there are other people in this book and other events that carry the NBA, you know, carry the NBA along.
Speaking of that, the trophy is named after one of the people that I knew very little about, Larry O'Brien. And I was blown away by this part of the book, because it's such a central name in the NBA, but so little's known about it. And I was curious, so this is just a one-off on you. Did you,
sure.
You know, what led you to writing about him? Like, how did you get information when there's just, I don't know, besides the trophy, and I know was a commissioner, I don't know much about him, you know?
Yeah, no, and no one really does. And I think part of it is just time. You know, he was a central figure in American politics for 20, 25 years. You know, but he was part of JFK's Irish Mafia. He was part of LBJ's cabinet. He was a major player in National Democratic Party politics. But, you know, time makes us all relevant. And I think, you know, Larry O'Brien's heyday was in the 1960s. So, you know, I barely remember what happened yesterday. So to ask somebody to recall a political figure who wasn't a president, you know, from that many years ago is a hard task. And that lack of knowledge, and I didn't know much about Larry O'Brien either, that's what made me want to learn more about him. And how did I learn more about him? Well, it's really just work. I mean, it's a three-part process. First thing was, I tried to find everything I could on Larry O'Brien. Mm-hmm. So I read his autobiography, No Final Victories, which was pretty good. It gave a little bit about what he was about and his life before the NBA. You know, there's a famous Time magazine article where he's on the cover of Time magazine article, where he's a subject. He actually made the cover of Time magazine. It's calling his friends and associates from the way back. And then I got lucky. One of the first people that I called was Larry O'Brien III, Larry O'Brien's son. And I said, you know, I'm writing this book. I don't know much about your father. I want to know more about him. Can we talk? And Larry was extremely gracious and extremely accommodating. I mean, again, I'm not a nationally known reporter. I'm not, you know, I'm not a big wheel at the Cracker Factory. So Larry took a lot of faith to trust me and to talk to me. And, you know, he sent me a bunch of stuff of his dad's, you know, memos from the NBA, a DVD about his father's life. And then in the course of conversation and talking, Larry said, you know, dad wrote an oral history of his time at the NBA. It hasn't been published. And my first thought was, well, can I take a look at it? And he said, yeah, you know, why don't you come down to Washington and you can take a look at it. So in 2018, I think it was July 2018, my wife and my then, you know, one and a half year old daughter made a 5-hour trek to DC, and I spent 2 days in an anonymous office at Larry O'Brien's office, just going through this oral history and taking notes and taking photos. And yeah, and I got, and that was a gold mine. And then, you know, you also talked to other, you know, I also, in going through the book, names come up. You talk to those names if they're still alive. I also talked to Jan Ackerhelm, who was Larry O'Brien's secretary for many years. So, yeah, if you talk, the more people you talk to, the more names you get, and those names lead you to other names, and they lead you to revelations, and that's really what this book was all about. It was just okay, you know, I know nothing. You know, I went in not just with Larry O'Brien, but with everyone else. I know nothing. So I'm going to talk to as many people as I can. And those people that I talk to, I'm going to ask them if they can direct me to somebody else. And that worked out really, really well. And it especially helped me filling in the blanks of Larry O'Brien's life, because yeah, like you, I had no idea about him. I just knew the trophy. I vaguely knew he worked for JFK, but in researching and reporting the book, I'm now convinced he's probably the most overlooked figure in NBA history. I think his value to the NBA is massive, and I don't think he doesn't get nearly enough credit for the role he played in shaping the modern day NBA.
We definitely make the case for that, and it's fascinating to read about. I mean, his role in the merger, and I think you had something where you talked about where there's his political savvy versus Stern's operational, logistical mind is just a fascinating to watch. They just came along at those perfect times. Like, he was the leader that the NBA needed at that time, and you did a really good job just telling that story of how they, you know, transition and help each other kind of bridge that gap between the two of them as well.
Yeah, Larry O'Brien, I really wanted to make Larry O'Brien's case clear. Because with Larry O'Brien, what he did more than anything else, and I think this is very clear in the book, is that he brought legitimacy to the NBA. You know, the NBA needed a headliner. They needed somebody who was going to make headlines to come in as commissioner. And Larry O'Brien was it. I mean, he was fresh off two terms as the head of the DNC. So that's a big name. Yeah. The NBA was almost a step down for him. Yeah. So for him to come in, that gave the league immediate respect, and it also gave the league a commissioner who wasn't a homer. Right. You know, Larry O'Brien didn't have any alliances. He didn't have anybody that he owed. He wasn't like, J. Walter Kennedy, the previous commissioner, you know, very much was aligned with the big market teams, with Ned Irish in New York and Red Auerbach in Boston. Mm-hmm. But Larry O'Brien had none of those connections. So he came in with a clean slate and was able to just, you know, be a leader and just sort of just rule straight down the middle. And the other thing that he did, and you mentioned this just now with Stern, was he made a case to hire David Stern full time, and he made him his protege. And that was absolutely huge, because in that role as protege, David Stern essentially became the commissioner.
Yeah.
He did all the dirty work, and that gave him a 5-year apprenticeship, 5-6 year apprenticeship. So that when David Stern became the commissioner officially in 84, he was ready to go. Right. He didn't need to, like, everyone knew who he was. He knew how the league worked. He knew how to get things done. And that's all Larry O'Brien. And, you know,
he's minted. Kind of, that's what politicians do, right? They mint the next guy.
Yeah, and that's what Larry knew very well how to delegate. That was Larry O'Brien's great gift, is that he wasn't somebody who was going to be an active leader. I think he was at the point in his career where he was too tired, he was too old. I think he was in his final days, and you know, people around him will admit that. But he still had that savvy to recognize talent and to delegate. He knew how to run meetings, which in the NBA, where it basically became like, a monkey fight at the zoo. Larry O'Brien just being able to keep order was a huge benefit. Yeah. But the biggest benefit, as I said, was him recognizing David Stern, giving him the title that he wanted, giving him the power that he wanted, and just letting David Stern do the work. And, you know, here we are, 40, 50 years later. And I think the proof is in the pudding. That was one of the best decisions Larry O'Brien ever made, was to say, okay, David, do your thing.
Yes, I think so. And I think it speaks to, though, a person's ability to step out of the way. And even, I mean, Stern has noticed that too, and maybe even, recognized it, although maybe you could argue he stayed even a little bit too long. But the thing about them too that I think is understated is that these guys love the game too.
Yeah.
And that one of the things, as an educator, that we ask new incoming teachers, like, I can teach you how to teach, but learning to, love the kids is something that's got to be in you. So, I mean, the fact that they loved basketball, I think, is step one. You can learn the logistics and, learn to delegate, but to love the sport is that central thing where they want to see it, succeed and grow, and to see other people do it and have fun with it, because ultimately it's a sport, and that they gotta find that joy in it too.
Absolutely right. And that's what the NBA did in the 70s into the 80s was they hired people who loved basketball. And you're absolutely right. I mean, yeah, you can, even at NBA Entertainment, the league's video and highlights arm. Don Sperling was the head there, and he wasn't really looking for technical prowess. He wasn't looking for somebody who knew how to cut film or how to, how to work in an editing bay. He just wanted somebody who loved the game. I mean, Don even told me, like, look, I could teach these people, these new recruits, how to do the stuff, how to edit, how to cut, how to do all those things. But I couldn't teach them the love for the game. And David Stern is a prime example of that. I mean, he grew up a giant basketball fan. And again, that love, I think, was what drove the NBA for a good two decades. Was, the people who work for the NBA, they not only love basketball, but they love the NBA. They cared about the NBA. Yes. And that was all David Stern's that all came from David Stern's leadership.
Yeah. I've got another kind of a sidebar story here, but it'll circle back to the Marvin Gaye song. So I read this part in the book about Marvin Gaye singing the national anthem at the All-Star game. And I have to substitute in the choir class at the middle school here. And we're out of time. And I'm like, what am I going to do? And I just listened to this chapter. I'm like, I bet none of these kids have heard this version of the song. And so we pop on YouTube and we all listen to Marvin Gaye sing that. And it was such a great, great little moment after listening to that chapter, because it's fascinating just how kind of, again, you wrap that story around how the NBA is changing with the culture. Mm-hmm. And it does. It still seems, very fresh the way he sings it. Not as radical as I'm sure it seemed at the time. But I'm curious, like, where, what that story meant to you, or how you even decided to include that in the book.
Well, that came the Marvin Gaye story, the Marvin Gaye anthem to me is the pivot point in the book, because that to me is the line between the old NBA and the new NBA. And the story, that chapter is actually based a lot on an article that I wrote for Grantland back in 2013.
Moment of silence that, there.
pardon me?
Moment of silence for Grantland.
Yeah, I love that site. Yeah. That was my first big story, and that the Marvin Gaye piece was wrote for Grantland, and after I wrote that story, I thought, okay, well, there's a lot here I couldn't put in. There's a lot here that there's also a lot that signifies the change of the NBA, not only from what I've seen, but also from the two dozen people I talked to who actually said, like, yeah, this is a pivotal point. So that story was really the really marked the beginning of me thinking of a book, thinking of, okay, well, this, there's a book here. So yeah, that's, so that story, or rather that anthem, I should say, is important on a couple levels, because A, I think it's a marvelous anthem. I was honored to be able to write about it and to be able to kind of just tell the how-to, or the origin story, or one of the people to tell the origin story, I should say. But to me, that writing that chapter and then talking to all these people who were there made me think, you know what, like there's this anthem was more than just a great anthem. It really marked the changing of the NBA. It marked a tipping point for the NBA to become a league that valued entertainment and a good time. And that wasn't going to shy away from being a quote unquote black league. It was not going to like hide from it. It was going to embrace what was on the floor. And to me, Marvin Gaye's national anthem at that All-Star game is a pivotal moment for the history of the NBA. And I also think it's a damn good anthem, but I'm curious, what do the kids think of it?
they liked it, actually. It's so fun. You watch people, I mean, Marvin Gaye is undeniably, like, I mean, I told him, I think he's got, I don't know if he's not my favorite singer ever, but
right.
You could argue that he's got the best voice ever. Like, he just, yeah. it's just undeniable to anyone. And, you know, it's choir class, so they're enjoying it. But it's fun because, of course, the anthem is a bit in the news for controversy. And sure. And to tell them, like, look, this was controversial at that time. So, you know, there's always a way to use, you know, moments to politicize things. And ultimately, what you're trying to do is express yourself and try to move the conversation in a positive direction if possible. And I mean, I think that's what he does. He comes out there with swagger and his sunglasses on, you know, able to be who he is and just opening up eyes. Some of the people are going to reject it, but a lot of people obviously embraced it, and it moves the conversation and culture in a positive direction, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, I think what's important about that anthem is that and Marcus Johnson told me this and I haven't forgotten it. Like, that anthem represented what was on the court. It represented the black NBA.
Yeah.
And, you know, for years, the NBA had trotted out, like, you know, kind of
old I think you hat. Said Pat Boone before.
It was Andy Williams, actually. Andy Williams, All-Star game. Okay. Robert Merrill. Yes, you know, yes. And again, these were all, you know, again, these are, yeah, they're great singers. Yep. And they're you know, they're nationally, internationally known singers. And but they didn't represent what was on the court, not only just in terms of the racial dynamics, but also the style. Like, I don't know. I mean, I'm certainly no musicologist, but when I think of Andy Moon River Williams, I don't think of a Magic Johnson fast break. No. I don't think of the NBA. But to me, what Marvin Gaye brought to that anthem, that to me is the NBA. It's soulful. It's beautiful. It's poetic. It's passionate, and again, it has all these musical elements that represent black culture, and it worked. It was the right song for the right moment. And you're right; people got upset about it. But it's funny if you look back at the sports columnists, you know, kind of venting about that. It looks so foolish. Ugh. I mean, it's those comments have not aged well. But that anthem is iconic. It's going to be around for another, it's going to be around forever.
It's got middle schoolers still bobbing their head. So that's a positive. I'll take that as a win. Mm-hmm. Speaking of that though, I think that it also represents something that you hit on, and that's television. And I'm curious, just how did you decide to get in? Because television is such an interesting part of the story. You know, there's the tape delay that you always hear about. There's CBS, giving up the NBA for the NCAA. I'm just curious, like, why did they do that? How did you get into just exploring that kind of that landscape? Because there are a ton of about how TNT started and just the shoestring nature. Oh, there's just so much good stuff in there.
It's hard. I mean, I don't know. It's funny. Like, that, I get those questions sometimes, and I sometimes think to myself, like, how did I do that? Or why did I do that? And a lot of that is just, this is going to sound really silly, but you know, a lot of this is a lot of writing anything is organization,
yeah,
and you know, getting your notes in a row, but a lot of it too is getting your notes in a row and getting the preparation organized in such a way that you feel that a writer feels confident to make leaps. Yeah. A writer feels confident, okay, to go in directions and follow the rhythm of the story. The example I always use is if you coil a garden hose, right? Mm-hmm. The garden hose goes in one direction. You know, you eventually lose it for a little bit, but you find that direction and you keep coiling the hose. And that's really what this book was. As you know, but to break it down into like A plus B equals C,
right?
You know, I think with CBS, I wanted to pursue that because you hear so much about NBC.
Yeah.
Rightfully so, you know, Marv Albert and Mike Fratello and Willow Bay and Ahmad Rashad and, you know, and Peter Vesey and all the, yeah. And they deserve their due, but the one thing that's true is that pretty much everything has a precedent. Mm-hmm. So like NBC had to come from somewhere. So, you know, in deciding on the year 75 to 89, I thought, well, okay, well, CBS was the main player back then. And they were absolutely, and you know, so they had to do something right to have the NBA for all those years. And lo and behold, like, yeah, you ask around and you dig around and you figure out that CBS really was a innovative, mm-hmm, and wonderful television partner for the NBA. And that's, yeah, for a couple of reasons. First, they gave a shit about the game. Yes. You know, that was the first thing. And a lot of that has to do with an executive producer named Ted Shaker,
yep,
who was pretty much just handed the NBA as like, you want it?
Good
you
know, luck. Good no luck. Yeah.
No one wants it. You want it, Ted? Like, yeah, sure, go. Yeah. So Ted Shaker took this. And then, you know, he came from the NFL Today, and that was a very innovative and creative show with Phyllis George and Brent Musburger and so forth and so on. So he began to put together elements that worked. They focused on camera work. They didn't, you know, on camera work that told a story. Ooh, you it. Know, they found announcers that could keep up with the game, that you know, that weren't going to be insulting or stumble over their words. You know, folks like Tommy Heinsohn and Billy Cunningham, people that were excited about the game. You know, they gave Brent Musburger another gig, and he fell in love with his role as a play-by-play guy. They gave personality to the games. You know, Pat O'Brien as halftime reports. They CBS Sports treated the games as entertainment. And the best thing that could have happened is that because CBS Sports had pretty much every sport under the sun, They could Ted Shaker and all the cameramen and producers, they had free reign. They could do whatever they wanted. There was no one telling, oh, we can't do that, you can't do this. And David Stern, being such a keen observer of what worked on television, and as someone who loved personalities and stories and entertainment and who knew that that was the key to getting fans into the NBA, it was an absolutely amazing partnership. And it was so good, in fact, that when CBS lost out on the NBA and the NBA went to NBC, Ed Desser, who's the director of broadcasting for the NBA, actually had notes he was ready to give to NBC of what they liked CBS, what they liked from CBS and what they wanted to do, what they wanted to see done. That's so like it was that good of a relationship, and it's a shame that it ended. Yeah. I mean, but it ended, I can get into that story, but it ended because CBS wanted the NCAA tournament, yeah, and the NBA didn't want to play second fiddle to them. And that was
probably fair.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the NCAA tournament is just, it's a
behemoth.
It's huge.
Yeah.
And, you know, but David Stern was somebody who had absolute confidence and absolute pride in his product. Mm-hmm. And he did not want to take a backseat to anybody. So when Neil Pilson, the president of CBS, is saying, look, David, we want to keep both of you. We want to keep the NBA, but we can't give you everything that you want. Like the NCAA tournament is going to take up March. That's just, yeah, the way that it is. he wasn't going to go.
There's just a certain, there's just a certain level of ego that you get to, and you've been that successful that it would be hard to, that's just a hard sell, right? Like you're saying what, you know, I can't imagine trying to do that.
Yeah, no. But CBS also dug its own grave because if you remember, they also spent $1 billion, I think, on baseball. Like it was really a terrible deal because I think it was something like 12 regular season games, the All-Star game, and the championship series and the World Series. And it was a disastrous deal because the first couple of series, the 1990 series, I think was a sweep. Baseball is also kind of a dying sport at that time. It was sort of losing momentum, and CBS took a bath on that.
Brutal. That's brutal. I wonder, it's probably impossible to for sure, you know, decide, but I wonder how much CBS played a role in, because you talk about the storytelling they did in the shift in the NBA from just, you know, as I think you had Leah Wilcox saying, the NFL is just laundry, but the NBA is the players. So they kind of make this shift towards telling the story of the players, because that's so much what the modern NBA is. It's so represented by the players. I mean, you and I were talking before we started recording how, you know, you almost can cheer for the NBA, right? Watch games because I like a player. Mm-hmm. LeBron moves around, but I just like LeBron. So wherever he's at, I'm just want to watch him play, you know?
Exactly right. And that was a David Stern mantra. It was just, let's focus on the players. Let's focus on what makes the game great. Let's focus on the personalities. And that's the thing, you know, the NBA didn't have any tradition, so they could do this. They could focus on marketing and image and all of those things that attract the casual fan or that attract the non-fan. And you're right. And again, like, you know, it bleeds to this day because I can't think of another sport where you have more players that are referred to on a first name basis.
Right.
So like that condition, that status today goes all the way back to the 1980s and 1970s with David Stern saying, look, let's put the players on t-shirts. Let's give them video. Let's put them on videotapes. Let's, you know, CBS, let's highlight Larry and Magic, you know, and that was all a deliberate strategy. And it absolutely paid off brilliantly because for a couple of reasons, you know, it's first, you know, you can watch any game now because, you know, if LeBron's playing, you're a LeBron fan or you're the same way that you're a Michael Jordan fan or a Magic Johnson fan. Mm-hmm. The other thing too is, this is something I've kind of thought as I've, you know, thought about the book and, you know, everything was, if you're a young fan and you don't grow up with a family rooting for a team, you are going to gravitate toward a player first. So the player is your gateway drug, so to speak.
Yeah.
So if you're an 8-year-old kid and like your parents don't like basketball, but you're watching the NBA on ABC or ESPN, wherever, and they're highlighting LeBron James, or there's a halftime feature on let's say Jason Tatum. Mm-hmm. Like that's going to be your way to get into that. Like those highlights, that's going to be the seduction to get you into the NBA. And once you're in the NBA, that's it. So the stress on an individual is something that the NBA has mastered for years. And the best part about that is that they can keep going back to that. Well, like the Celtics may be good and bad. The Lakers are going to have off seasons, but like great players are always going to come in. And if you market those guys and you tell your TV partners, hey, look, you know, let's stress this as Giannis versus James Harden.
Yeah.
Or let's stress this as Jimmy Butler versus Steph Curry. That's going to continue the cycle. Yeah. And you can do that until the end of time.
I love that. You hit on something in there too that becomes a big part of the book. And we actually on the podcast like talking about the business aspects of just 1999 in general, because I think it is fascinating to watch whether you get there like Salem Sports did, but just to hear the stories of these companies because, you know, I think that's the fun part. You know, you get to the end and they're this giant multinational, and
yeah,
that's great. Obviously that's where you want to get to, but the ride, you know, which you're able to detail with, you know, Nike too, a little bit in here is so interesting and so fun. Thanks. All the things that come together. So just curious where you know, how you picked out on Salem first, and then kind of, what was the breadcrumb trail for that part of the book?
That's a good question. The breadcrumb trail was I was a kid, I had those shirts. And I always wondered, like, well, you know, as I get older and, you know, I wonder, like, where the hell did that, what the hell was up with those guys?
Yeah.
Like, you just, and that's my driving force as a writer, as a freelancer, is like, I always have a question, like, what happened to that? Or where did this go? Or how did this happen? Like,
yeah,
that is always kind of, that's sort of my North Star.
That's great.
So in 2016, I was lucky enough, I pitched a story to RollingStone.com about Salem Sportswear. And, you know, and to me it was such an innovative company, but also in the report, originally it was one of those things where it was like, yeah, these were like weird shirts, short shirts. It's like the players are the big caricatures. And,
yeah,
but then as I did the reporting, you know, people were telling me like, yeah, these were really the first like personality driven, like apparel. And these guys came from nowhere. And then that was just good luck. You know, just, I wrote about them for Rolling Stone. The story turned out great. I thought, I'm biased, but,
that's okay. We approve that.
Oh, thank you. The story turned out really well, but again, there was more that I wanted to tell. I wanted to tell more about how these guys got to where they were. I wanted to tell more about the business side of it. And, you know, Salem Sportswear is so interesting to me because they really came from nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also just, they really were flying by the seat of their pants. And it shows just how small potatoes the NBA was, because right, they're partnering with this company, yeah, that like 3 years ago was like making, you know, shirts and like in a screened in porch, you know, at their mom's house.
That's a great,
you know,
it was, picture.
Yeah. Keith Keneally and Kyle Nagel. So like the NBA like was all about ideas. And that was the thing that was so great about the company back then, was that if you had a great idea and you were willing to work hard to see it go forth, you were in. And Salem Sports was a perfect example of that. It was like, okay, you know, there's this product, and the NBA just calls them and says like, hey, like, how come you don't have a license from us?
Mm, yeah.
So that just goes to show you just how it was the NBA was really a small business. It's one of those like, okay, you know, like we'll take a flyer on these guys and see what happens. They have a good product. They work hard, and we'll go from there. And it's that would never happen today.
No, there's so many layers.
But it's crazy.
Yeah.
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 And Nike too is a funny story because they're such a conglomerate now. But like back in the day, it was like, you know, Michael Jordan, we're gonna roll the dice on this guy. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
But it's
yes, dad, his dad, right? Even kind of playing the pivotal role in bringing him in. It's just like, wait, what?
Yeah, his mom, like, yeah, we're gonna be on that plane. You be on this plane, and then, you know, it's funny. He was sort of just this, you know, like, we're gonna put our money on this rookie. He hasn't played a game. You know, he's great, but like, we don't know how good he's going to be. And it's that, but that's the thing now, like, you know, I'm always averse to use the phrase a simpler time, like, oh, but this really was a simpler time.
Yeah.
It was just, you know, it was a lot of let's just see how this works. And a lot of small businesses that were innovative. I keep using that word, but it's true.
Yeah.
And plucky and just wanted to work hard. And the NBA just saying, fuck it. Like, let's just give these guys a chance. Or like, all right, we'll try it this way. Like, you want different colors for this? Great. Okay. We can do that. And that's just goes to show you what the NBA's, what makes the NBA such a vital business force.
Right.
Is that there are two things. There is no tradition. So if there's a good idea, if it works,
go
for it.
Yeah.
And there's also the mantra that I think still sticks to the NBA today, which is from David Stern, is that he hated to hear the phrase, this is how we've always done it. So he did not like there to be – so the idea that you have to have an institutional style or kind of just be do things a certain way was poison to him. And I think those things have stayed with the NBA up to present day. But that wild spirit of like, let's just roll, let's just do this, let's just give two guys in Salem, New Hampshire a chance to, you know, make t-shirts for us and that kind of adventuresome spirit. That, you know, it's the NBA is too big for that now. But back in the day, you could do that, and you can do that, and no one would really bat an eye.
Man, that's amazing. So there's so much in here that keeps going. I love the international part too. I want to give a shout out to the Lee Ellis part in the book from the No Dunk Starters guys. Big fan of those, and to Bobito Garcia. So we got to talk to Jesse Washington, and he talked a lot about Bobito and that sneaker culture that you really hit on. There's a bunch of hip hop stuff in here. There's just so much. Like I want to encourage anybody who's listening, go get the book, read the book. Like it's fun to listen to this, and it's been, I so appreciate you kind of spinning some of the stories in different directions, but the text is like you will definitely learn something. If you're a small business owner, it's got some business ideas. I love Josh lets me pitch him half-baked ideas sometimes when I come down and talk to him, so I've got a couple from the book, some half-baked ideas for him, and he has to fully bake them, but I like pitching them from different things.
I think you've explained the book perfectly. I don't think this is, to me, the best sports books are never just about sports. Mm. And to me, this is a book that goes off in a lot of different directions. And the NBA is sort of at the center, pulling all of them in. So it's a book that, you know, I wanted to write a book that if I were a basketball fan, I'd want to read and I would enjoy. But I think there's a lot here that kind of just shows how the NBA got to become this mammoth cultural and business force. And that's something that I wanted to explore and get to the bottom of. And I think I got there. I mean, maybe there are a few stones unturned, but hey, you know what? I'm only one man and I got a daughter and a wife. So there's only so much time.
I've got a half-baked idea to pitch you here at the end, but I've got a couple of, quick hitters here. Before I get you out of here. All right. First one is during my background research, I found that you wanted to be a movie critic at one point.
Yes.
So, give me a couple of the best basketball movies of all time, or your personal favorites at least.
Oh man. You know, it's, yeah. I mean, long ago, I wanted to be a movie critic, which looking back now was a misguided idea for a variety of reasons that I'm not going to get into. Yeah. But yeah, you know, there are several that I like. You know, White Man Can't Jump is a movie I go to quite a bit. Hoosiers is a favorite. I know that some people don't like it. I mean, to me, it's just like pure Hollywood hokum, and I can't resist it. You know what? A couple of other movies that I like that I don't think get enough love. This is gonna sound crazy, but Just Right with Queen Latifah is really good.
Okay,
like,
I love it.
I watch that. Just sort of, I mean, I watched that because I was writing. I used to write a basketball film column for Hoop.
Perfect.
A few years back, so I watched that because like, oh, it's NBA related.
Yeah.
And I was just, to me, I was like, this is surprisingly good. And like Queen Latifah and Common have really good chemistry, and the story is lovely. And it's adult. Like it's not, you know, too syrupy or too silly.
Nice.
That's a really good one. Love and Basketball is a really good film. I don't think people give that enough love. Let's see. Those are the four. I'm trying to think there's a fifth one that I kind of gets lost. You know what a good documentary is? I don't see enough people talking about it. Is The Other Dream Team about the Lithuania 92 Olympic team with Arvydas Sabonis and Šarūnas Marcelionis and a few other key players.
Yeah.
That's a really good documentary that came out, I think, in 20 like 2011 or 2012.
Okay. Yeah, they've got the Grateful Dead shirts and everything.
Yep. Yeah, that's the Donnie Nelson team. Yeah, it's a really good documentary. I think it might be on NBA TV occasionally. Like you'll see it, passing along the cable scroll.
Okay, let's switch from movies to books. So I'm sure that you obviously read a bunch of NBA books, as some background for this. So what are a couple of your favorite NBA or basketball related books?
Oh man, how much time do we have?
I know that's like, a quick hit. It's a quick hitter. You just got to off the dome.
Oh man, I mean, off the top of my head, let me think. Oh boy. Okay, Terry Pluto's Loose Balls, his oral history of the ABA is. A book that I love. I've read that probably four or five times. I think it's an amazing book. Okay, the two David Halberstam books.
Okay.
Breaks of the Game and his book on Michael Jordan are excellent. David Halberstam, just an amazing journalist who died too soon.
Yeah.
Those are great books. Let's see what else. Oh man, this is gonna kill me. Anything by Jack McCallum is great.
Wow, he's so good.
He's a wonderful writer. His book on the Boston Celtics, Unfinished Business, is terrific. You can get it from your local library. Jeff Perlman's book on the Showtime Lakers, Showtime, is great. And that's going to be turned into a limited run series pretty soon.
Oh, really? Nice.
Yeah, on HBO. So that's in the pipeline. Oh boy, Kate Fagan's the Reappearing Act is really, really good. It's about her coming out as a lesbian when she was a basketball player at Colorado State.
Interesting.
When she was a player there, and a very good player. Oh boy, what else? I'll keep going. there's so many. That's the thing. Like, there's so many books that you should read after this one or before mine. I keep going back to Bill Simmons' book. It's huge, but it is. I didn't grow up with him, but like I started reading him when he was with Page Two with ESPN.
Yeah.
And when he wrote a basketball book, I just kept going back to it, even though there are books that I like better, but for some reason I just get hooked in with the debates and all that stuff. So that's a book that I go back to pretty frequently. Yeah. Let's see. I'm trying to think of anyone else. Oh boy. I'm going to forget someone as soon as I get off here. You want to take a look behind here, but
that's all right. I know. Yeah. I was going to, you've got some cool, a lot of books behind there, and I see maybe possibly the Orlando Magic, trade board over your other shoulder. I was trying to figure out what's on your whiteboard. If that's Orlando Magic, trade.
No, that's just demented scrawls of people I have to contact for book publicity for stories.
Love it.
A few other books. Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's Giant Steps, his first autobiography, is great. It's an it is a very candid, very forthright read, which I think it's out of print, but you can get copies somewhere. 24 Seconds or Less. I believe it's Leonard Schechter. No, it's Leonard Coppett, about the early days of the NBA is wonderful. And it's a great it's a terrific read from like 65, 66. Let me look around here. I'm going to forget something. Second Wind, Bill Russell's memoir, Taylor Branch's autobiography. Excuse me. It's a great book. It is extremely it's very much like Bill Russell, just wise and honest and bracing. It's great. And then some recent books that were good. Yaron Weitzman's book on the Sixers, Tanking to the Top, is really good. Sean Fury, a friend of mine, he wrote a great book about the history of the jump shot called Rise and Fire.
Nice.
That's still available for purchase. Very good book. Sean's a good guy. I don't know. I mean, I could go on so for many. 30 minutes.
Well, I'll tell you what, the Terry Pluto book, that's been on my list. I've been hearing that so much lately, so you'll have to come back on after I read. I haven't read it yet, so I'm going to have to – I'll hit you up if you want to come back on. We can talk a little Terry Pluto because I'm fascinated by that era of the basketball history.
Terry Pluto has written, I think, three of the best basketball books of the last 40 years.
Crazy.
There's Loose Balls. There's this book with Bob Ryan, 48 Minutes, which breaks down a 87 Cavaliers-Celtics game. And there's Tall Tales, which is about the early days of the NBA. Those are all outstanding. Huh. And Terry is, I mean, again, he's, I don't know how he's able to keep a job as a columnist and write great books. It's incredible.
Yeah.
To me.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's, you know, all these books are available from your local library. They're available online. It's, I don't know. I mean, again, I could speak for 35 minutes about just great basketball books or great sports books and, you know, irritate all the listeners who are remaining with my voice as I
that's perfect as it doesn't
as
matter
I wax poetic.
It doesn't matter, I'm taking notes, so it's just for me at this point anyways. Okay, my half, speaking of just for me, my half-baked idea. So I'm listening the other day, and there's this overtime league, and I don't know how I hadn't heard about this, but they've got this Jeff Bezos money, and I'm curious about if this is an inflection point for college basketball, and you know, wondering. They're going to create this new league. There's going to be some way that college athletes start to get paid, or at least that age gets to be paid on a more significant level. But this is specifically, I think, even maybe pushing down into the high school ranks. But they seed funded $80 million. So I'm thinking that they need a chronicler for their time. So you got to get that Bezos money.
Dude, I don't have the strength. I don't have the strength to just, you know, go down and
drill down in
the
it.
Hell that is.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I do have ideas for books that I want to pursue. Good. And
yeah, where are you going next? What can you give us, like, the genre that you're looking at? Even,
you know, I have a couple of ideas. One that is a sequel in spirit to From Hanging on the Prime Time, but not a direct sequel. And the other one is about a completely different sport.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, it's funny. I'm always coming up with, you know, my livelihood is based on trying to convince other people to pay for my idea, whether it's a book or a story or whatever. So, like, you know, I could be shoveling snow or raking the lawn.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hey, you know, this could be a good idea for a book. I mean, there are two ideas that I have that I think would be really good books. I don't think I've been written before. But we'll see. You know, I'm optimistic that I'll be writing more books in the future. I think I can make a career out of this. If not, you know what? I did it once, and that's more than most people do. So, you know what? If this is the only book, and I'm, you know, back to writing stuff that, you know, generates scant interest, that's okay. Yeah. You know, I still get to work in my bedroom slippers. So you know what? It's a good trade.
It's not so bad. A lot of people have discovered that's all right over the past year. Well, Pete, I so appreciate it, and just want to thank the listeners for joining us and encourage them to go out and get Pete's book. If people want to follow you, just what's some social media or where would you encourage them to pick up the book at?
Yeah, well, thank you. In terms of following me on social media, pretty much Twitter is where I hang out. That's my home base. So at Pete Croato, and that's Croa, two T's as in Thomas O, at Pete Croato. So yeah, I'm on Twitter, you know, it's mostly my job at this point. That's where the editors hang out, other writers. So yeah, it's sort of my professional hangout. In terms of where you can buy the book at just about any major brick and mortar or online retailer. There we go. However, if you want an autographed copy, you can get one via Odyssey Books, the Odyssey Bookstore in Ithaca, New York. If you go to Odyssey Bookstore, that's Odyssey Bookstore.com, you can email one of the sales people there or call them to request an autographed copy, and I'll happily personalize it. And the store will ship it pretty much anywhere for an extra $5.
Cool.
Also, if you buy the book and send me proof, whether it's a receipt or a book or just a, hey, great job there, champ, I will happily send you a signed book plate. So there's no charge for that. You know, I'm happy to pay the postage. I've sent them off to Wales. nice. It's fun for me to do it.
Yeah.
I'm happy to do it.
Get
so
you,
yeah.
Get you a map out
those
there.
Those are kind of the, what was that?
Get you a map of where all the places. That's fun.
Yeah. There's some beautiful places. Yeah. Just, you know, just, it's like Forrest Gump's run, just, yeah, you know, exactly. Just crisscrossing America. No, but those are the two, you know, if you can get it from an indie bookstore or from Odyssey Books, that'd be great. And the signed book plate, that's open until the end of time. So if you buy the book, you like it, I'll jot something down for you.
Love it, Pete. Well, thanks so much, man. I'm gonna get you out of here.
Aaron, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. This is great.
Thank you for listening to the 19.9 podcast. If you haven't already subscribed to the podcast, make sure you do. And while you're there, leave us a rating and review. 5 stars like the basketball camp. We also have links to all of 19.9's social media so you never miss a release. Until next time.